Hello, my name is Michael Albert, and I am the host of the podcast titled Revolution Z. In this, our 68th episode, our topic is sports in a future participatory society. I'm not going to talk about the virus and sports, not simply because there are a few sports even happening at all during the pandemic, but because there is so much written and said already on the topic. So even though some may feel strange talking about sports in a desirable future, and not about the monumental crisis we are trying to navigate in the present, that seems to me a more constructive, hopeful, and even instructive use of time. At this point, talking about participatory socialism's implications for athletics and athletes ought to be relatively easy. It is barely different than for science, art, journalism, and economics writ large. There is, however, one interesting new angle to address, the issue of competition. First, as with other realms of human endeavor, participatory socialism ensures that those who do athletic activity as part of their balanced work responsibilities will be remunerated for their effort and sacrifice. They will have balanced job complexes and self-managing work situations, and they will operate in accord with participatory planning. For those who haven't initially heard or gone back to catch up with early episodes that are devoted to the main features of a liberating classless economy called participatory economics, here in brief is what that shorthand means. No one gets income for their property, which is called profits, nor for their bargaining power, what they can manage to take, and not even for the value of their contribution to the social product. Instead, everyone who works, athlete or otherwise, gets income for how hard they work, for how long they work, and for the onerousness of the conditions under which they work, as long as their work is socially valued. They get more if they work longer, or harder, or at worse conditions, not for other reasons. Everyone who works does a mix of tasks called a balanced job complex, such that their overall job is comparable to every other overall job in the empowerment effects it conveys. In other words, we each do a mix of tasks. Some of those are onerous, some are empowering. So we each have, on balance, comparably empowering work lives. This means that 20% don't monopolize empowering tasks and circumstances, while 80% get to only carry out orders and be subordinate. We are all comparably prepared to participate in life's decisions. What the empowerment ratio of playing tennis as a part of one's work, or golf, or running, chess, or soccer, might turn out to be, we can only guess. But various participatory sports industries will have jobs that are internally balanced among responsibilities, such as playing, training, coaching, traveling, maintaining the fields and stadiums, transporting, cleaning, medically maintaining athletes, taking tickets, and on, and so forth. And then also between their broad industry and the rest of the economy. Likewise, like all products, the inputs and outputs of athletic industries will be cooperatively negotiated in the planning process by workers' councils in industries that provide bats and balls, food, bandages, bikes, and other inputs, by those that provide sports events and opportunities, and by consumers' councils expressing their preferences for athletic consumption. More, the councils will collectively self-manage in light of their own capacities and preferences and those of the broader populace. It might be interesting to ask how a sports team will be redefined, including how coaching will be handling and tasks distributed and motivated. But just as it is beyond current capacities to delve deeply into such detailed matters for symphony orchestras, movie actors and crews, writers and directors, or for that matter, for truck drivers, cooks, or metal workers, so too it is beyond our capacities for athletes and for others associated with delivering athletic performances to decide their assessments in advance of their experiencing the changes. We can say a bit more about athletic remuneration, however, and it is revealing to do so. And after that, we can address a much broader question that may be troubling some readers. Would athletics even exist as something that is remunerated in a participatory society? Would bicycle riding exist only as an enjoyable hobby and pastime, but not as the Tour de France with remuneration? Would people play chess with friends, but not in tournaments as part of their income-earning work? Would there be hobbyist leagues for hockey and cricket, football and soccer, tennis and golf, chess and bridge, bowling and car racing, and baseball and basketball, maintained by people earning for their labors, but without people doing such sports activity itself for pay? Assuming for now that people continue to earn income for playing sports, remuneration will be for intensity, duration, and onerousness of work. Of course, just like everything else. But what does that mean in this context? Consider a contemporary marathon race. Currently, the total prize money might be $1 million. If so, in capitalism, the first place winner might win $400,000, second place might get $250,000, third place $100,000, fourth place $50,000, and the remaining $200,000 might be awarded in steadily diminishing increments to the next 30 or 40 finishers, with another 1,000 or more finishers earning nothing for their efforts. If we consider instead the whole baseball, golf, soccer, track and field, bowling, car racing, or chess industry, each rewards its players similarly over the course of a year, with participants going from tremendous earnings at the top performance levels down to near zero, or even below zero, since many athletes pay their own fees for transport, equipment, etc., for a large majority of lower performance levels. What changes about this picture in a participatory economy? Consider the marathon again. In a participatory economy, marathon remuneration isn't for where you finish in the race, but for the effort and sacrifice you expend in socially valued labor. If society values your sport and its products enough to warrant its being part of the socially planned economy, then as a participant, whether your main activity is athletic, organizational, maintenance, medical, or whatever, you will get remunerated for the duration of your socially valued work, for the intensity of your efforts, and for your work's onerousness above or below the social average, but not for output, such as where you finish in a race. Indeed, suppose you are, among your other responsibilities, a runner. Suppose you come in first or fifth or 150th, and please note, just how slow a runner can be and still be considered a producer of a valued output is a matter that will be determined by sports councils and their hiring practices and by participatory planning and establishing what is sought by audiences for running just as for baseball, hockey, soccer, and other sports. Which, parenthetically, is why I couldn't be a quarterback for the New England Patriots or play singles at Wimbledon. My product, throwing or hitting a tennis ball, wouldn't come into the arena, the ballpark, the universe of being considered socially valuable. So what difference will your finishing position make to your income? The answer is, it will make no difference unless you are doing better or worse in the race due to extra duration or intensity of work, not due to natural talent, since only duration intensity is remunerated. In other words, if you are a natural-born jackrabbit competing in a marathon, you can't waltz across the finish line first, expending little effort in the race and in preparing for it, and expect to get high remuneration. And even if you did exert more than the social average, and if you worked overtime to get ready, the extra income you would thereby earn would be proportionate to your useful effort, not to your results. Your income would therefore certainly not be humongous, but socially sensible. And this remunerative approach is not only morally sound, which is to say, one shouldn't be remunerated extra for natural-born talent, or even for the output of training, as compared to the difficulty, intensity, and duration of training, but it is also economically sound, which is to say that it has the appropriate incentive effects, eliciting maximal performance for athletes as for everyone else. What a runner needs as an incentive to run faster is not inordinate reward for natural-born talent, because the runner can do nothing to enhance genetic talent, and rewarding talent actually involves incentive only to win, even if at a much slower pace than one is capable of. What does provide incentive is remunerating for the extra effort that goes into running faster, or lower income for not expending full effort. This is all well and good, and also is consistent with participatory socialism more broadly. And so by this time in Revolution Z, this kind of logic is hopefully not surprising. But the question still remains, will athletics exist as an economic industry at all, not just as a hobby in a good economy? Of course, I don't know. It is for future citizens to decide. But as a guess, why not? Why won't future citizens of a classless economy want to watch excellent runners, bikers, kickers, shooters, passers, and hitters, just as we do now, as exemplars of human performance in their respective fields? In that respect, how is it different than people wanting to see or hear the work of painters, poets, novelists, sculptors, singers, composers, or other performers? If in a good economy, we want to have symphonies or other performances, movies or shows, with remuneration for their valuable production and performance, why wouldn't we also want to have athletic events to watch, to aspire to admire, and to enjoy, including providing remuneration for their valuable production and performance? Many critics of capitalism will have doubts about this, I suspect, because many leftists dislike sports for their macho dynamics, their racial biases, their violence, commercialism, and class inequalities. But all this will be gone in a good society and economy. Just as we don't like the pharmaceutical industry, vehicle industries, and even farming for their profit-seeking, racism-ratifying, and sexism-soliciting, we will still, of course, want to have production and distribution of medicines, vehicles, and food. Why wouldn't we want to have sports as well? I suspect many leftists will acknowledge that there is no need to jettison production per se, consumption per se, allocation per se, but instead only a need to produce, consume, and allocate without ecological, racial, and sexist profit-seeking, among other ills that we want to leave behind. But I suspect many leftists will nonetheless remain suspicious that competition imposes conflict among people, and that competition per se is in that sense detrimental and should be left behind. Critics of competition may say that while an orchestra aspires to the highest quality it can attain, and while we admire performances in accord with their quality, and while we likewise enjoy and respect some compositions more than others, and while we admire and enjoy some paintings, poetry, and novels more than others, to succeed, no such product requires that other such products fail. There is no intrinsic necessity for winners and losers. One doesn't have to play to win, but only to contribute. But with sports, this critic might add, winning and losing is often intrinsic to the activity. In a good society, the critic argues, this quality should make sports unworthy of being considered an industry with remuneration for workers. What might be the counter-argument? First, it is correct that a great many sports intrinsically involve competition. We can conceive of competition-free alternatives, but they are not the same thing. In the late 1960s, I used to play with friends a non-competitive brand of basketball. We did score and defend when playing the game, but the score wasn't germane and needn't even be kept. A very good offensive player, who was defended by a not-so-good defender, would try to play in such a way as to bring out the defender's best possible defensive effort. The expert on offense had the difficult challenge to elevate the defender's effort, rather than scoring easily over and over. Similarly, a very good defensive player, covering a not-so-great offensive player, would never shut down the player entirely over and over, but would instead play with just the right tenacity and intrusiveness to spur the offensive player to play his or her best. Playing this way was fun and challenging, but it wasn't basketball of the sort people enjoy when watching competitive NBA, college, or high school games. And of course, there are many sports and games in which there is barely even a way to imagine a fully non-competitive variant, say chess, the 100-yard dash, a marathon, car racing, or the pentathlon. So what about the competition, urges the critic. We can't want to reward and esteem the competition, can we? Well, it is true that a central virtue of participatory economics is that participatory planning removes competition from economic allocation and also makes remuneration non-competitive. There is no zero-sum contest in participatory economic remuneration in which if I win, you lose. However, this is deemed a great economic virtue not out of an a priori rejection of competition, but because it allows the economy to propel rather than violate solidarity, diversity, equity, and self-management. So is competition per se a problem? If we don't increase income for the winner of a contest, and we don't reduce income for the loser, and if winning and losing have no bearing on workplace influence and self-management, and if they don't lead to benefits in job definition and conditions, would competition still be problematic? Participatory socialism doesn't deny that performers and producers have different capacities. On the contrary, participatory socialism has standards and admires excellence. You can't get remunerated in a participatory economy for work that isn't socially valued. You can't play ball poorly, lay bricks poorly, or tend sheep poorly for pay. To get paid for work, it must produce socially valued output. which means it must be done at a rate and productivity that isn't wasteful of resources and inferior in outcomes. I may want to be the point guard of a basketball team like the Warriors, but Steph Curry is so galactically better that the public would not value and indeed would be horrified by my work at that position. My play is simply not good enough to be worthy of employment as a point guard people would want to watch. There is a competition in this sense for any balanced job complex that includes being a point guard. Indeed, there is also a competition in this same sense for all jobs. You have to be good enough for your work to be socially valued in any job, but your income isn't a function of how good you are. Suppose, for example, that I want to be a physicist or an airline pilot, or that I want to do heavy labor or play the oboe as a defining part of my balanced job complex. So do other people, and in some cases, many more people than society needs. There is a type of competition, therefore, for the honor of being able to be socially remunerated for each type of work. One must fulfill the social standards to get hired by a workers' council. If I can't fulfill the social standards sufficiently to be producing desired output, I can certainly read physics books, fly model planes, lift weights, or play oboe as a hobby, but I can't do these things for my income. Thus, a participatory economy is not without competition. But in participatory socialism's competitions, winning or losing doesn't determine a level of pay, a level of influence, or conditions of work. What the competition does, instead, is to generate, reveal, and utilize competence. The competition thus yields something that we all benefit from without denying values we hold dear. Can athletic competition be similarly positive without negative side effects? I guess time will tell, but I don't see why not. Suppose you play a game of chess, and yes, I happen to think chess is a sport with struggle, challenge, and endurance, but if you prefer to just think of it as a game, for our purposes here, that doesn't matter, with an opponent. Does the quality of your chess playing experience depend on whether you win or lose? It certainly might. It could be that you get more pleasure out of winning against a weak opponent easily, for example, even if you have played mundanely and inattentively due to your being a much better player. Then you get pleasure out of just barely losing a finely played and very challenging game, due to your opponent being a bit better than you, but with you playing at your absolute best. If so, it is mostly winning and losing that affects your mood, not the quality of your play. On the other hand, can we imagine a society in which you typically get more pleasure out of playing really well and a really challenging and exciting struggle that you lose than you get out of winning easily? Isn't this what we tell our kids, in fact, all the time? That it's how you play the game, not if you win or lose, that matters, and that this is true even though you must try to win for there to be a game at all? The effect of participatory economics on sports would certainly be profound. It would not mean that teams and individuals wouldn't try to win. It would mean, however, that their incomes would not be pegged to winning or losing. We would want to see and admire and even emulate quality as now, but we would not reward quality per se. Would athletes and audience celebrate winners or celebrate people that manifest their capacities fully, or both? Would fans get more pleasure out of their team winning easily while playing poorly, or out of their team losing a close, hard-fought struggle, but playing well? In a good economy, would people no longer be paid for playing chess because there must be a winner and loser? Or would competitive chess persist, including championships, because we value quality of play and wish to observe, study, and enjoy talent, endurance, and effort in chess like in so many other areas, but without win-based reward or loss-based penalty? What about golf, soccer, or basketball? For that matter, would football or boxing disappear for being too violent? What would become of car racing, horse racing, or marathons? How about archery, javelin, or pole vaulting? We can't know the answer to these questions, not least because different societies may answer differently, any more than we can know what will happen in other industries in the future. Nor is there any reason to be agitated about our inability to predict future preferences. A vision for an economy or for any other part of life, such as sports, isn't about figuring out what choices future workers and consumers will make. We don't need or want that degree of prediction or blueprint. It is about figuring out what type of institutional relations will permit future workers and consumers to make the choices they prefer for themselves, while furthering values they hold dear. We can confidently assert that participatory socialism will make equitable the way athletes are remunerated, will balance their jobs, and will no doubt also impact the way athletes are viewed and their influence in society. We can also assert that participatory socialism will likely change the way people regard and enjoy competitions. Today's star athletes earn millions and lord it over most of humanity. Literally millions, tens of millions, in some cases hundreds of millions. In a participatory future, star athletes will earn incomes and be treated like all other citizens. Now, sports are subordinated to profit and power. In a participatory future, sports will be like all other economic pursuits, solidaritous, diverse, equitable, and self-managed. The precise details of the future content and texture of athletics, whether undertaken for remuneration or in leisure time, as with the precise details of the future content and texture of music, art, literature, transportation, education, technology, dining, fashion, science, sex, or anything else, are for future citizens to work out in their own free fashion. What an advocate of participatory socialism can sensibly now urge and fight for is only that people exercise their economic preference through workers' and consumers' councils, using self-managed decision-making, being remunerated for effort and sacrifice, fulfilling balanced job complexes, and abiding participatory planning. But that is just enough, or in any event, whatever we adopt as a sports vision needs to be just enough to guarantee that participatory socialism will satisfy the requirements of enlightened athletics and vice versa. Participatory economy is a sports-friendly economy. Before we close this episode, I would like to offer a word about the current crisis, and also, however hesitantly, about Revolution Z. I am no expert in any area of discovery related to the tumult we are now all experiencing. But for what it is worth, I keep my eyes peeled for some reliable report on whether getting sick and then recovering conveys any significant immunity. Likely it does or it doesn't, and no matter how bumbling and criminal, as in the U.S. response to the crisis, or competent and courageous, as in Cuba's response, immunity or not may prove decisive in just how horrible this gets. Beyond that, gathering material daily for ZNet, I am struck by a few things beyond or other than what is constantly and ubiquitously reiterated all over progressive and left media. First, it is that Corona has chased virtually everything else off the stage, not in fact, but in coverage. The reasons for this are obvious, but it is not obvious that yet another essay saying what many others are simultaneously saying about Corona is more of a contribution than attending to other also important matters. Sometimes, even, hard as it is to believe, more important matters, such as the climate crisis. Second, to my eyes, people are writing longer and longer pieces. Am I misperceiving? Is this true? And is it because writers are feeling a bit desperate about getting their voice in? Is it true and simply a function of writers having more time to write? I have no evidence one way or another. It is just an impression. But I keep feeling it with each new pile of incoming content that I go through for ZNet. And third, is anyone reading at all, or reading those parts that are most helpful, instructive, insightful, and not just repetitive, at least? Again, I have no idea. For myself, I try to take a walk daily, sometimes twice daily now. It's not new for me, except that nowadays I do that for engagement with external nature. And that's it for my exercise. In fact, that's it for forays into the world beyond my four walls. And I am betting, and at any rate hope, however odd a thing it may be to hope for, that you all are doing similarly for the duration of our new, currently worsening, but hopefully before too long, declining Corona crisis. I am watching a lot of TV too. Nothing particularly admirable in that, clearly, but no sin either. It fills some hours that need filling. The same goes for reading more novels than usual. And I do my work because I can at home, work on ZNet and on Revolution Z. I am also contemplating rewriting a screenplay I have been unsuccessfully trying to get film interest in. It is about activist successes over the next 25 years. If I don't deep six it, it will at some point need refinements that take into account the gigantic new feature that is the coronavirus. But I tend to think to try to incorporate it now is premature. Perhaps in a few months we will know enough to try. I'm also thinking about trying to write a very accessible, but also a very uncompromising, simple but not simplistic, account of what participatory society can accomplish and how to attain it. This I could do now, I just have to work up that motivation. Which is to say, my own life is disrupted by fear and sadness, but it is not diverted much from what it would have otherwise been this year, because in my experience, the pastimes of a writer are rather lonely, even in the best of times. On the other hand, eyeballing dwindling financial reserves does add some additional angst. So, by way of reminder, if you think a podcast addressing vision and strategy for fundamental social change is socially valuable, it would be worthy in a worthy society, then perhaps even in this disgraceful excuse for a society, perhaps you could visit www.patreon.com/revolutionz and give me a little assistance. There you can become a patron of this effort and help ensure its future, perhaps even its growth and enrichment with new features as well. I hope you will consider the option. For that matter, there now being 68 episodes available, perhaps listening to a few that strike you as potentially interesting from earlier would be a good way to fill some of the many new hours lots of us suddenly have available. I hope it would. Try it. I think maybe you will like it. And that said, this is Michael Albert, signing off until next time for Revolution Z.